White Network presents Hitler's Table Talk, Study Out. Reading and commentary on the after-dinner monologues delivered by Adolf Hitler from 1941 to 1944 and transcribed by AIDS.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and listeners and students of the Hitler's Table Talk. You know, when I say this good evening the same way, I want to say the international Jew, so I have to get used to Hitler's Table Talk. I want to welcome you to our March 13th, 2014 episode of this new series. We're only in episode 2 because we just started it. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and your other host is?
I'm Ray Goodwin.
All right. And tonight we're going to start reading from the beginning, and it does begin on July 5th, 1941, 2 weeks after the beginning of Operation Barbarossa on June 22nd. So would you say Adolf Hitler was in a pretty good mood at this time, Ray?
Most definitely, Carolyn, and I appreciate you pointing that out because that was one of the things that I was going to lead off with if it wasn't mentioned, that June 22nd, of course, was the launching of Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet. And, of course, in the early months of that war and for some time, everything was going quite well for National Socialist Germany.
Well, exactly, and it was such a brilliant beginning, you know. It's too bad it ended the way it did.
Absolutely.
At least, not everybody feels that way, but Hitler was vindicated, and he proved, or the invasion proved, that Stalin was already set up for attack, and that's why it was so successful, because all that material and men and so on were lined up there close to the border. Planes and tanks and so on. And so the Germans just had a field day, shooting all that stuff down and shooting it up. But then they also had a whole bunch of prisoners of war to deal with.
Exactly.
More than they bargained for.
And the Russian artillery, armor, airplanes, tanks, you name it, were all there for offensive purposes. They had absolutely no idea that they would be fighting a defensive war right quick. And, so it knocked them back very solidly. And as you read the table talk, I don't know if we'll hit many of the messages today, but I think I remarked to you that there's an optimism in the things that Hitler says. He's in very, very good form, and he's talking in terms of when this war is over, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And of course, at this time, too, the fighting is just primarily on the Eastern Front. So things look pretty rosy for Germany at that time.
Well, that's right. And so that's a good thing to keep in mind as we start reading what he says here. And I also want to mention before we get started that I think after going over these first parts that I think we'll be able to get through today, I don't know how much we'll get through, but it's not like the International Jew where we have a chapter to do and it pretty much will fits into the time schedule that we have. It's a shorter and longer, different days. It's divided up by this day, that day, and dinner and you know, midday, supper time and late night and so on. Whenever he was talking and whenever it was being taken down by the adjutant that was doing it. So, we don't know how long it'll take us to do any particular part. But this is, I think, what really struck me is that it's more difficult. It's going to be more difficult for listeners to grasp it and get the meaning of it than the International Jew was, because in that, the writer was this, William Cameron, who was a newspaper writer and had been a newspaper editor. And as I thought about it, I thought, well, he knew how to write for them in a way that almost everybody could grasp and understand it. It was still very intelligent, you know, but it wasn't difficult to follow. And I know that as we read it, you could just listen along and, you know, unless there was things to talk about, there was no need for any explanation. But I think this is going to be different, because it's not, for one thing, well, you know, Hitler is talking, but he has his own style of speaking, and then it's translated from German to English. And then you have, it's not always as well put together as an English sentence when something is translated, because the translator needs to get the exact meaning as well as possible, plus put it into good English or readable English. And sometimes I think, you know, I'm just, as I'm reading along, I have to go back and go over things and really concentrate on it. And I'm thinking, what are these listeners going to be doing if we go too fast? You know, so if either you or I think something needs to be explained or, you know, that is being said, well, we'll just do it.
Sure.
So we won't be in a big rush to do this. So, but I would like you to start reading, if you don't mind.
Okay, certainly.
All right, let's get started.
And you want me to start with this Saturday, 5th of July, 1941?
Yeah, just
okay.
Read all that. Read,
okay.
Read that part, too.
All right. The these are all right after the dates. There's always let in with 2, 3, or 4, maybe even 5 little lines of subject matter that's fixing to be referred to. And in this instance, Aryans and Russians, the necessity of the mailed fist in Russia, deterioration of the soil.
Yeah, and I don't know who wrote those things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But maybe it was the, maybe it was Bormann.
That was my thinking.
Yeah, I think it's a part of the, I don't think it's the editors that put it in there.
No, I don't either. I think it was because it was a part of the organization of those notes.
Yeah.
All right. What we need is a collective view of people's wish to live and their manner of living. We must distinguish between the fascist popular movement and the popular movement in Russia. The fascist movement is a spontaneous return to the traditions of ancient Rome, which, by the way, Hitler was very, very favorably disposed to. The Russian movement has an essential tendency towards anarchy.
Already I stop, you know,
yeah.
and say that, you know, he says so much in just a few sentences.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, so he's talking about fascism and in a sense saying that this is not a natural way of organizing themselves amongst Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
By instinct, the Russian does not incline toward a higher form of society. Certain peoples can live in such a way that with them a collection of family units does not make a whole. And although Russia has set up a social system which, judged by Western standards, qualifies for the designation state, it is not, in fact, a system which is either congenial or natural to her. It is true that, in a sense, every product of human culture, every work gifted with beauty, can be born only of the effect of the constraint which we call education. The Aryan peoples are peoples who are particularly active. A man like Kreml works from morning to night. Such and such another person never stops thinking. In the same way, the Italian is as diligent as an ant. In the eyes of the Russian, the principal support of civilization is vodka. His ideal consists of never doing anything but the indispensable. Our conception of work, and then more of it, is one that he submits to as if it were a real curse. And it's doubtful whether anything at all can be done in Russia without the help of the Orthodox priest. It's the priest who has been able to reconcile the Russian to the fatal necessity of work by promising him more happiness in another world. Now, Carolyn, I'm going to comment right there on that. I found that pretty interesting because that harkens back all the way to the Middle Ages, when the peasantry had such an existence, such a drab and nothing to look forward to existence. And you think about the Russians, for the most part, extreme poverty, even under the Tsar, you had an elite and the rest of the people were scratching for something to eat. And so he's exactly right in that analysis there, because of the fatality outlook of the Russian, they would turn to vodka, be heavy drinkers to escape their drab existence and no future. And so the priest, then, what Hitler says is the Orthodox priest is able to reconcile that Russian by promising him happiness in another world.
If he behaves himself and does what he should,
yes.
You know, what the church teaches, like you got to go to work every day or you got to do your work, you got to support your family, you got to do this, got to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah,
right. Well, I'm glad you stopped there because this is just so interesting because there's always this talk about, well, Hitler had this negative attitude toward the Russians and the Slavs, and this is just proof of it, you know, but I can't think that he's wrong in what he's saying here. In that, what he's saying is that the Russian does not have that same sense of discipline and, desire to, make things better that the German does. And somebody was saying just today that I heard, and of course it's a truism, that Germans go wherever they go around the world, wherever they, you know, emigrate, to, they make things better. They're always, you know, their whole thing is to, you know, do, see how things can be and make them better. And that's really the whole idea that Hitler had about this whole war in the East and in his ideas about the East, but we'll get into that later. But, he's saying that the Russians don't have that, not the, average Russian, and that they do only as much as they have to do. That
right.
they're not going to work beyond what they need. Once they get what they need, mm-hmm. they won't do more. And like sort of like if you've got your own little farm or something, and you feel like one day you don't want to do anything, you just don't do anything. Whereas the another person who was more disciplined would make sure he went out there and worked at his farm every day and succeeded more. But the Russian will, as long as he's got a roof over his head and this peasant, he could be, you know, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but amongst the Russian peasantry, that could very well be true. And that could be one of the reasons why their leadership was so tough on them. Like the Tsar and so on, and then they ended up with the Bolsheviks and so on. And you might feel sorry for them and say they've been exploited, but at the same time, maybe, they kind of invite that by their own way of life and lack of ambition.
True.
So, this is basically what he's saying. I think it's, very interesting. And he says that nothing can be done without education, that we can't improve our cultures without education. And he says another thing, he is speaking as though the Russians are not Aryans, and he's saying the Aryan
right.
people are particularly active, and then he's comparing that to the Russian people who don't do anything but the indispensable, what they have to do. And this was his belief going in, and that's why he said to his people, you've got to be tough on these people, and we've got to take charge, and we got to say what's going to be done, and you're not going to be asking them, for their permission or anything like that, because that was his opinion.
That's right, and that was the phrase, the little sentences that outline this, about the mailed fist, you know, why the mailed fist is necessary in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he's talking about. And in this next part right here, of course, reading it, just as we do, it's like, boy, he's really taking a slap at these people when he says the Russian will never make up his mind to work except under compulsion from the outside, for he's incapable of organizing himself. And if, despite everything, he's apt to have organization thrust upon him, that is thanks to the drop of Aryan blood in his veins. It is only because of this drop that the Russian people has created something and possesses an organized state. It takes energy to rule Russia. The corollary is that the tougher a country's regime, the more appropriate it is that equity and justice should be practiced there. And then he draws the little comparison here. The horse that is not kept constantly under control forgets in the wink of an eye the rudiments of training that have been inculcated into it. In the same way, with the Russian, there's an instinctive force that invariably leads him back to the state of nature. People sometimes quote the case of the horses that escaped from a ranch in America and by some 10 years later had formed huge herds of wild horses. It's so easy for an animal to go back to its origins. For the Russian, the return to the state of nature is a return to primitive forms of life. The family exists. The female looks after her children, like the female of the hare, with all the feelings of a mother. But the Russian doesn't want anything more. His reaction against the constraint of the organized state, which is always a constraint since it limits the liberty of the individual, is brutal and savage, like all feminine reactions. When he collapses and should yield, the Russian bursts into lamentations. This will to return to the state of nature is exhibited in his revolutions. For the Russian, the typical form of revolution is nihilism.
All right, let's stop there too, because
yeah, good idea.
Now this can be really seen as being very insulting to the Russian, because you're comparing him to an animal. See, that's what people will say. Oh, he's comparing the Russians, the Slavs, to animals. Well, right. He's just using a, as you said, a analogy here.
Sure.
about if it's in the nature, which he does think it is, of the Russian to be somewhat indolent and not do more than is necessary, the Russian peasant, then if you can kind of force him into being different, you know, by having a strong state. But if left alone, he'll go right back to where he was, because that's his
nature.
And I think for Hitler, your nature was, and I suppose it's National Socialism, the nature is kind of set, and you're not, and I believe it is. I don't think you can really change people that much.
I agree.
Do you?
I agree, yes.
Okay. Well, what do you think about this? I don't know if we need to explain that the constraint of the state of is, which, let's see, when
yeah, it's the, always, which is always a constraint because it limits the liberty of the individual.
Yeah, but he's saying the reaction of the Russian to that
is brutal and savage.
Yeah, brutal and savage when he has a revolution.
Yes.
So that he'll just, you know, really destroy
tear everything up.
Mm-hmm. Tear it all down.
Sure.
Calls it a feminine reaction. I don't know if he thinks the Slavs are more feminine or something, but in any case, we need to talk about this nihilism. You know, I looked it up to make sure I had it right.
I did too.
Yeah. And it's a life without objective meaning, purpose, or intrinsic value, but more it has to do with morality, that morality does not exist objectively. And there's not really any established values. It's kind of like the social construct idea that we have with Marxism, cultural Marxism. And can even go so far as to that real knowledge is not possible, and even reality does not actually exist. So everything is kind of like, I guess, a perception, and you make your own rules then.
Yes, yes.
It's very anti-God, isn't it?
Yes, I had it as the rejection of all religious and moral principles and extreme skepticism about real existence. Which is just, hey, to hell with everything, let's live for the moment, type thing. And there's no consciousness of the world around you or any kind of existence, particularly of a deity. So,
right. And he's saying that he says this will to return to the state of nature is exhibited in the revolutions of the Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, he's really taken out here, but I don't think he's being mean about it. I think he's thought about it, and this is what he sees. So, go ahead, we got a little bit more.
Yeah, I think it's Hitler's observations of many, many decades and centuries of history, and he was a student of that sort of thing, among many other things, and I think his observations are from what he has seen and learned over his life, and he says, I think there's still petroleum in thousands of places. As for coal, we know we're reducing the natural reserves and that in so doing, we're creating gaps in the subsoil. But as for petroleum, it may be that the lakes from which we're drawing are constantly renewed from invisible reservoirs. That's a fascinating paragraph to me, living here in Texas, and because of the petroleum down here and the taking it out from under the ground. And where he mentions taking out coal and, you know, we're reducing the natural reserves and all, but then he adds here, without doubt, man is the most dangerous microbe imaginable. He exploits the ground underneath his feet without ever asking whether he's disposing thus of products that would perhaps be indispensable to the life of other regions. If one examined the problem closely, one would probably find here the origin of the catastrophes that occur periodically in the Earth's surface. And that is so right on with this fracking that you probably mm-hmm. heard of, that sort of mining, that there was an earthquake. And down here where we are in south central Texas, earthquakes are unheard of. I mean, there have been a handful of very small ones, 20, 30, 40 years apart. But they had one within 40 miles, 50 miles of here the other day. Now, we couldn't feel it here, but over there it measured about 2.5. And that area that it happened is the center of so much of this fracking things like this. So, and I've read of that happening in other places now, sinkholes and things like this. And so I think Hitler's observation there was so, prescient that it really fits today here in Texas for sure.
Yeah, he was like that, wasn't he? You know,
yes.
And you know, it's funny that thing, you know, he was talking about the Russian and so on, and then he went, he's thinking about Russia, then he goes off into petroleum. Mm-hmm. But although the other thing that we should remind the listeners is that the person who was taking the notes was only taking what he thought was important. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Hitler could have been saying a lot of other things.
It's a good point. Yeah.
That were not all that important, you know, in between these things, and he didn't take all that down. So anyway, he did shift over to because that was on his mind all the time from going into the Soviet Union. He knew he wanted to get hold of those oil sources there.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most important thing that the Germans needed, was oil along with food too.
That's exactly right.
And so he was always working on that with the generals. I suppose we'll come up to some of that somewhere along the line later on. But I have heard stories about myself that the truth about oil. There's some people who say this. The truth about oil is that there's not a limited amount of it.
Right,
like
it's
we're always taught.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that down there in the earth, it's being replenished really not over millions of years, but pretty fast.
Right.
So we're not going to run out of oil, and that's a big old either a lie or people didn't understand one or the other to keep the price up.
Exactly.
So he seems to be aware of those things. And back then, which I don't know if anybody was talking about it, but he was so amazing. I do believe it has to be true that he had this retention ability. So whatever he was reading and coming across, if it seemed to apply, he could retain it and he could pull it back up later when he was talking about things like that. I just think he had quite an extraordinary mind.
True.
All right. Well, I'll read number two.
Okay.
And then you can be stopping me whenever you want to comment on something.
Okay. Now, I didn't know if you were going to say anything about this, that particular entry, Carolyn, but there was something there that caught my eye, which I thought was interesting. And that's just, you know, it says, you're fixing to read there, the night of the 5th, 6th, July, 1941. He puts the time there, which is interesting to me, 11:30 p.m., to whatever says 1 something a.m. whatever, that these observations are made. And that seemed rather unusual to me because I kind of pictured Hitler as maybe a early riser and only...
Oh, no!
You know,
opposite.
certainly going to bed at a reasonable hour, but with these dinner parties or wherever it is that he is in the... making these comments and all, 11:30 p.m. seems a bit late in my imagination.
Well, it does to you, but Ray, no, that was his habit. That was his habit all the time. Uh-huh. Even when he was young, he liked to stay up very late. Uh-huh. I think he didn't want to ever stop doing what he was doing, and then he would go to bed so late he'd have to sleep late, so he just got into that. And if you were, amongst his party there, his inner circle, or staying in his pure bunker and so on. You didn't have to get up early unless you wanted to, because he wasn't up, and you didn't. They always had a very late supper. They'd have lunch about 2 o'clock or something like that, and then they'd start supper like around 10. And then and he'd stay up. They say until 3 o'clock. Mm-hmm. At least 3, and then finally go to bed. He didn't get up till about 11. Now, he might have woken up earlier, 10 or something, but he wasn't out and about until around noon.
Right.
So anyway, I'm glad you brought that up. And, this is the night of that same day, previous conversation was lunchtime. Now we're in the supper. And another thing that I noticed, so many things to talk about right in the beginning. We won't always be going so slow, listeners, as we're going today, but that they call it luncheon. You know, the midday meal is luncheon, and the end of the day meal is supper. They don't call it dinner. They call it luncheon and supper. And we did that in my family.
Hey, that's what we Southerners always call it. Dinner was the noon meal, and supper was... What's the evening meal?
Well, our noon meal was lunch for weekdays, but on Sunday, when we ate in the midday, and if we ate in the midday with our main meal, then it was dinner. But if we ate our regular evening meal, it was supper. Mm-hmm. So,
interesting.
Anyway, and then we just had a cold lunch, usually maybe some soup or something on weekdays, when I was in school and stuff like that growing up. Okay, this one, the little key words are the shortening of night of 5th and 6th July, 1941. The shortening of space by roads, the frontier of the Urals, the Moscow must disappear, and the treasures of the Hermitage. A lot of stuff covered here, but it's not all that long. The beauties of the Crimea, which we shall make accessible by means of an autobahn. For us Germans, that will be our Riviera. Crete is scorching and dry. Cyprus would be lovely, but we can reach the Crimea by road. Along that road lies Kiev and Croatia, too, a tourist paradise for us. I expect that after the war, there will be a great upsurge of rejoicing. So, he's seeing how all these areas in the east on the Black Sea and so on are going to be a wonderful vacation spots.
And that's one of those very positive remarks right there too, Carolyn, that he said, that last sentence you read, that he is in a great frame of mind. It was something like, after this war, there's going to be a great upsurge of rejoicing.
Yeah, well, he's seeing it as, we're going to, of course he was always positive all the time.
Oh yes.
Insisted on being, even if he didn't always feel it, he would work on himself till he got into that mood. But here he didn't have any trouble with it because everything was looking very good. And so he was already seeing how it was going to be and how nice the Germans were going to make it. And I think the thing to remember here was that they did not intend to exclude the Slavs from the enjoyment of their land and all of these things, but that they were going to be managing things because they thought that that's the only way it would be the way they thought it would be, as good as they wanted it to be. So he goes on, better than the railway is the Autobahn. He's talking about the Autobahn. Better than the railway, which has something impersonal about it, is it's the road that will bring people together. What progress in the direction of the new Europe, just as the Autobahn has caused the inner frontiers of Germany to disappear, so it will abolish the frontiers of the countries of Europe. Well, now there he's sounding like a European Union, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But his idea was not quite the way they've done it.
Yeah.
At all. So, okay, I won't belabor that point. To those who ask me whether it will be enough to reach the Urals as a frontier, the Urals is that big mountain range in Russia, pretty far east. I don't know. Can you say exactly where it is, Ray? I mean,
No, you know, that's usually referred to as kind of the dividing line between Asia and Europe.
Right.
I wouldn't want to guess as to like how far it lies in between, let's say, Paris and Moscow, or miles wide, or Berlin and Moscow, about halfway there, or is it closer to Berlin?
Oh no, it's way back in Russia.
Yeah,
Russia.
It's east of Moscow. Oh, okay. Well,
it's all the way back in there. But that was like they felt that if they conquered Russia to the Urals, that was far enough, and they could just leave the rest of it, drive mm-hmm. everybody who didn't want to be, you know, wanted to, all the enemies, the Bolsheviks or whatever, back behind there and just leave them there. And then they would put up a big, frontier security line, and they, you know, and defend it. And
yes.
They would, you know, then control things that way. So he says, I reply that for the present, it is enough for the frontier to be drawn back as far as that. Okay. That was far enough for him. What matters is that Bolshevism must be exterminated. So here he's saying, you know, that what he wants to exterminate is Bolshevism.
Correct.
Not Russians.
Right.
Right. In case of necessity, we shall renew our advance wherever a new center of resistance is formed. Moscow, as the center of the doctrine, the Bolshevik doctrine, must disappear from the earth's surface as soon as its riches have been brought to shelter. There's no question of our collaborating with the Muscovite proletariat. Anyhow, St. Petersburg as a city is incomparably more beautiful than Moscow. You know, now he says bringing the riches of Moscow to shelter. People need to notice that. He's mm-hmm. not saying he wants to bring them to Germany or something like that.
That's right.
He wants to
take them out of harm's way.
Yeah, he mm-hmm. wants to save all that stuff. And but somehow he thinks that the whole city of Moscow needs to go. Mm-hmm. Because it's the center of this pestilence.
Correct.
Called Bolshevism. So then the last paragraph of this night here is probably the treasures of the Hermitage have not been stored at the Kremlin as they were during the First World War, but in the country houses, unless they've been shifted to the cities east of Moscow or still further by river. So he's just speculating,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there he is, always the artist, you know, always interested in culture and very concerned with saving the cultural treasures of Europe and of Russia. And so a lot of those were European there and of wherever, you know, and it was a very different. It was his love for the art accomplishments of Europeans and of all white people. It wasn't the kind of avarice that the Jews have of wanting to own it for themselves or mm-hmm. steal it. So he probably talks about things like this fairly often in these mm-hmm. conversations.
Sure.
All right. Well, you go on then. We'll take
okay.
turns like this. With
well,
number
good. Three. Number three, and I really appreciate this part that's coming right here because to me it is so the essence of National Socialism. Night of 11th, 12th, July, 1941. The natural piety of man, Russian atheists know how to die, and no atheistical education. Those are your lead-ins topics. I think the man who contemplates the universe with his eyes wide open is the man with the greatest amount of natural piety, not in the religious sense, but in the sense of an intimate harmony with things. At the end of the last century, the progress of science and technique led liberalism astray into proclaiming man's mastery of nature and announcing that he would soon have dominion over space. But a simple storm is enough, and everything collapses like a pack of cards. In any case, we shall learn to become familiar with the laws by which life is governed, and acquaintance with the laws of nature will guide us on the path of progress. As for the why of these laws, we shall never know anything about it. A thing is so, and our understanding cannot conceive of other schemes. Man has discovered in nature the wonderful notion of that almighty being whose law he worships. Fundamentally, in everyone, there is the feeling for this almighty, which we call God, that is to say, the dominion of natural laws throughout the whole universe. The priests, who have always succeeded in exploiting this feeling, threaten punishment for the man who refuses to accept the creed that they impose. When one provokes a child to fear of the dark, one awakens in him a feeling of atavistic dread. Thus this child will be ruled all his life by this dread, whereas another child who has been intelligently brought up will be free of it. It's said that every man needs a refuge where he can find consolation and help in unhappiness. I don't believe it. If humanity follows that path, it's solely a matter of tradition and habit. That's a lesson, by the way, that can be drawn from the Bolshevik front. The Russians have no God, and that doesn't prevent them from being able to face death. We don't want to educate anyone in atheism.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to say there. What do you want to say about it?
I mean, absolutely it is. And I think that right there is a firm dose of the actual philosophy of Adolf Hitler, the reality of nature and the harm that superstition does. And he mentions that when you provoke in a child a fear of the dark, you know, this child never really progresses because he's afraid of superstition or whatever. But intelligently brought up, he's going to be free of that. So anyway, it's kind of what it meant to me.
Yeah, well, I saw, where he mentions right there in the first paragraph, the that natural piety, he believes in natural piety, which he says is not a religious thing, but is a sense of an intimate harmony with things.
Yes.
And that's definitely him. He believes
yes,
being
exactly
in
right.
harmony with things, and by that he meant nature in large
sure.
part.
Exactly.
And that to him was, and it is to many of us. I know it is to
yes.
you. That is,
yes. That's God.
That is the spiritual, yeah. that is the true spirituality that we would want to have. And then he talks about science and technique. You know, in Hermann Giesler's book, they use the word, there's lots of times it was translated as technique, and I was having a little bit of a hard time understanding what he meant by that, but it came down to is just the use of physical materials for building. He talked about that a lot in the architectural discussions, but methods and techniques and so on, but the technique was kind of like the type of physical material you use determines how you're going to build something or what it's going to look like or, you know, how it's going to be done. So there's progress in that also. There's progress in scientific understanding and also progress in new materials. And for a lot of that is man-made materials, mm-hmm. you know, that have come to be used. Or steel, like he was really, really had a big theory and was very interested in the Eiffel Tower. That it was something brand new built out of steel, you know, instead of stone and masonry and so on. Mm-hmm. And he was just, of course, everybody knows his great interest in architecture, but he had this interest in everything. And, you know, and he was very forward thinking and pro-science, pro-scientific improvements and so on. And that the idea that man should have mastery of nature, he disavows that.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. And he says just a simple storm shows that everything that man builds collapses immediately.
Who's really in control, yeah.
Right. So let's see what else here. And then
That very last sentence, Carolyn, I wanted your take on that. We don't want to educate anyone in atheism. That's a good statement.
Well, and that shows that that he had this spiritual religious sense, mm-hmm. and people want to turn it into, well, was he a Christian or not? And we're going to get into more of that, but in fact, it's coming right up. Oh, you know, how Christian was he? No, he wasn't. Yes, he was. But he didn't like organized religion all that much, although he respected its place and so on, and he wasn't trying to disturb it. But for him, it was a God thing, and a God thing he found in himself, and he found it in nature. He found it in his own inner self, and in so many ways, and that was always very real to him. So he was a mm-hmm. he was a religious man, yes. for sure.
Yes, and by educating, I think that I'm just speculating here that his thoughts might have run to, if we educate anybody in atheism, we rob them of the realization of the beauty in nature. We take away so much from them, and in essence, we would do what the damn Bolsheviks have done and are doing, which is the antithesis of what National Socialism stands for. And so anyway, that's the way I saw it.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And then he also does mention the priests here just a little bit, but even in that, there's a lot to take from it. He mm-hmm. talks about the Almighty, which mm-hmm. we call God, and he likens that to the dominion of natural laws throughout the whole universe. Now, real Christian people, I don't know what you'd say, they don't like that because they think that sounds like paganism. They don't want mm-hmm. to worship nature, you know. Right. And then it sounds like, well, you're saying you can worship God through nature, but no, they say no. You have to, you know, come to the church's teachings and do that mm-hmm. in the right way and so on. So good. That becomes controversial when it just seems like a healthy, wonderful person's way of thinking to me, you know.
Yes, yes.
And then he says the priests, excuse me, he says the priests have exploited this feeling, mm-hmm. And threaten to punish people if they don't accept the creed exactly as it's given, you see. So right there he's indicating that anti-church thing. He's not anti-God, he's not anti-Christ,
that's exactly right.
But he's really anti-church.
Yes, yeah. That the church takes away the very naturalness of man by mm-hmm. their dogma.
Yeah, and making people guilty for things that
yes.
probably they shouldn't be like, which when I thought of the fear of the dark, I thought of hell, you know, of teaching children about hell, mm-hmm. is something that makes people afraid for the rest of their life if they really take it in and believe it.
It's all about control, and it has been for centuries.
Right. Well, okay, so we'll get started in this part four. I call it part four. It has a number four in front of it, but it's mm-hmm. The night of, and I don't have the date of it, but why don't you just start reading it, and we'll see, maybe somewhere partway through, if you don't stop yourself, I'll stop you to talk about it.
Okay. I think that was intended to be the night of the 15th of July, but we'll just guess at that. Now, this is very good right here. National Socialism and religion cannot exist together. No persecution.
Well, that's what probably, if Borman wrote these notes, and that's what Borman wrote. mm-hmm. See, I don't know about these headings, you know, but I do think they're a part of it, and it kind of gives people an idea what's coming up.
Yes, yeah, and that's what these are. The lead-in sentences are what's fixing to be touched on. Yeah. No persecution of religions, let them wither of themselves. Bolshevism, the illegitimate child of Christianity. Origin of the Spartan gruel, the Latvian morons, Stalin, one of history's most remarkable figures. When National Socialism has ruled long enough, it will no longer be possible to conceive of a form of life different from ours. In the long run, National Socialism and religion will no longer be able to exist together. On a question from C.S., whether this antagonism might mean a war, the Führer continued,
No. Now, let me say just right here that I was thinking about who CS might be.
Mm-hmm, me too.
And I think it's probably Krista Schroeder, mm-hmm. one of his secretaries, because she was always there. And I couldn't think of any other CS. And he liked his secretaries. And he answers this real politely and everything. And that's the way he would do to a question asked by her. When she says, with this antagonism, mean a war, I think she means a war with the church.
She means.
Not the war that's going on. Yeah.
Right. And he says, no, it does not mean a war. The ideal solution would be to leave the religions to devour themselves without persecutions. But in that case, we must not replace the church by something equivalent. That would be terrifying. It goes without saying that the whole thing needs a lot of thought. Everything will occur in due time. It's a simple question of honesty, and that's what it'll finally boil down to. In England, the status of the individual in relation to the church is governed by considerations of state. In America, it's all purely a matter of conformism. The German people's especial quality is patience, and it's the only one of the peoples capable of undertaking a revolution in this sphere. It could do it if only for the reason that only the German people has made moral law the governing principle of action.
Okay, so he's still talking about religion here and talking about a revolution in religion, and then he later goes on to talk about Luther. But, you know, that's what he's saying, that, and I don't know. I think this is interesting that he says the German people have made moral law the governing principle of action. There's a lot of truth in that. And if you think about it, you think, well, hasn't everybody? And then you'd have to say, no, they haven't all. Not quite the way the German people did. And whether that's good or bad, that's one sign that Andreas Westerle says has made Germany come out on the poor end of the stick in negotiations with other countries who aren't stopped by the morality of things.
Exactly.
The way the Germans have been.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, I think so too. It's one of my favorite things he's ever said.
Mm-hmm. The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity. Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child. Both are inventions of the Jew. The deliberate lie in the matter of religion was introduced into the world by Christianity. Bolshevism practices a lie of the same nature when it claims to bring liberty to men, whereas in reality it seeks only to enslave them. In the ancient world, the relations between men and gods were founded on an instinctive respect. It was a world enlightened by the idea of tolerance. Christianity was the first creed in the world to exterminate its adversaries in the name of love. Its keynote is intolerance.
Well, this is a very important paragraph
I think so too.
Has been quoted many times in many ways, and it has a lot of these things in it that Christians don't like, and they cause that. A lot of this is why they say that this is not Hitler; he would never have said these things. Mm-hmm. Well, he may not have said it in quite this way. We got to remember that this is translated from the German, but he was also making some points here. And when you're talking. As we all know, to friends and so on, and you're having a discussion, you will say a lot of things that you might not say if you're giving a speech or it's going down in history. And so even though somebody was taking notes here, he was just expressing some thoughts that he had. And the way I see some of this is that I thought this sentence was interesting. Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child, meaning that Christianity led to Bolshevism through illegitimate means, that Christianity was perhaps distorted into something that could lead to Bolshevism. That's the way I see it. And there again, you go to the official church religion, what the doctrine has become. And who was responsible for that, for some of the things in the religion. So, and then he says both of these were inventions of the Jew. So it could also mean that, in his thinking, he was saying that the Jews distorted Christianity, and made it partially into what it is today. But, you know, a lot of people say that Paul did that, and they're anti-Paul. There's all these different ideas. I used to think that. And that if it wasn't for Paul, Christianity would be more simple and what it should be, more like Jesus and blah, blah. But I don't, you know, that's just for people to debate.
That's coming up later in this book, Carolyn.
Yeah.
There's a discussion of that very thing. Now, Christianity, the great leveler, you know, equality, everybody's the same, all this stuff. Bolshevism preaches the same thing.
Right.
Now, to me, it's important in this paragraph here to realize that Hitler is still talking about an organized religion. He doesn't take Jesus to task. He doesn't cast aspersions on Christ. In fact, it's the other way around. Usually when he mentions Jesus and his war against those who were trying to kill him. That is such a powerful paragraph, right there. But you can see readily what you just mentioned there, how it can be used to, by those who hate Adolf Hitler, or want to turn people even more off than they already are of the man, is mention this very anti-Christian stance that he takes. That's why some would say, well, yeah, this book got printed because the Jews wanted it to be printed, because they wanted stuff like that to cast aspersions on Adolf Hitler. They want the populace to see, you know, and read that stuff. So that is something that we talked about last week, about we're going to have to go along in this book and learn as we go and form our opinions as we go and as we learn more and more about these conversations, rather than jumping off right away and saying this is how it is, because we don't know. I mean, we're still digging.
Yeah, I understand. You're very right about that. But this is a sentence that right here that people are all upset about, and that is, the deliberate lie in the matter of religion was introduced into the world by Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people say he never, you know, that has been put in there, and very, you know, that this was not really there and so on. And there's proof of it and blah, blah. But anyway, even if you look at the sentence, if we're talking about Christianity as something that's been distorted early on, and then there was a lie that was put in there, and then that lie was sent out to the world. Well, you know, I guess you can get around anything if you want to.
Yeah.
You can see things. If you want to see it, you know, one way or another way, you can find a way to do it. And that's maybe what I'm doing here. All right. Well, why don't you go continue?
Okay. Without Christianity, we should not have had Islam. The Roman Empire, under Germanic influence, would have developed in the direction of world domination, and humanity would not have extinguished 15 centuries of civilization at a single stroke.
Now, Ray, I have to say here that talking about the Roman Empire, and you mentioned earlier that he was, you know, he thought highly of it, and he did, and he has said things like this in other places, and I'm going to be bringing in probably now and then the book by Otto Wagner, in which he wrote down all the things that he recalled, long conversations by Hitler, statements, and even, you know, whole paragraphs, both, you know, as quotes by Hitler talking. He spent a lot of time with Hitler during those years, 1930 to 1933, after Hitler had become chancellor. One of the chapters was all about this, and they were at a museum or something, and Hitler was talking away about it. So it's things like that, and also the way he, the things that are very similar to what Giesler says and quotes Hitler as saying to him, make me think that this is not made up by somebody, but this really is Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's it. So.
Okay. Let it not be said that Christianity brought man the life of the soul, for that evolution was in the natural order of things. The result of the collapse of the Roman Empire was a night that lasted for centuries. The Romans had no dislike of the Germans. This is shown by the mere fact that blonde hair was fashionable with them. Amongst the Goths, there were many men with dark hair. The Italian, Spanish, French, and English dialects were created by mixtures of local languages with the linguistic elements imported by the migrant peoples. At first, they were mere vernaculars until a poet was found who forged the nation's language. It takes 5 or 6 centuries for a language to be born. The conqueror of a country is forced to adapt himself to the local language. That is why language is not the immovable monument on which a people's characteristics are inscribed. A people's way of eating, for example, is racially more typical. For every man remains persuaded in his heart that his mother is the best cook. When I tasted the soup of the people of Schleswig-Holstein, it occurred to me that the gruel of the Spartans cannot have been very different. In the time of the great migrations, the tribes were the product of ceaseless mixtures. The men who arrived in the south were not the same as those who went away. One can imagine 200 young Frisians setting out for the south like a tank setting out across the country and carrying with them men belonging to other tribes. The Croats are certainly more Germanic than Slav. The Estonians, too, have a lot of Germanic blood. The Estonians are the elite of the Baltic peoples. Then come the Lithuanians, and lastly, the Latvians. Stalin used Latvians for the executions which the Russians found disgusting. They're the same people who used to have the job of executioners in the old empire of the Tsars. Stalin is one of the most extraordinary figures in world history. He began as a small clerk, and he's never stopped being a clerk. Stalin owes nothing to rhetoric. He governs from his office, thanks to a bureaucracy that obeys his every nod and gesture. It's striking that Russian propaganda, in the criticisms it makes of us, always holds itself within certain limits. Stalin, that cunning Caucasian, is apparently quite ready to abandon European Russia, if he thinks that a failure to solve her problems would cause him to lose everything. Let nobody think Stalin might reconquer Europe from the Urals. It is as if I were installed in Slovakia and could set out from there and reconquer the Reich. This is the catastrophe that will cause the loss of the Soviet Empire.
Well, there he was really, really being, confident. And, he saw Stalin as a worthy opponent, and he says in many places, you know, he did have a lot of respect for Stalin. Mm-hmm. And I imagine it grew over time, but at this point, he thought he was going to drive him behind the Urals and, he would not be able to recover from that. You know, there's so many things said there, but maybe they're not the most important. We've got 60 seconds to go, so if you have any final comment you want to make on this, go ahead.
Well, most people listening, I imagine, are concerned about the religious talk and things like this and how negative it may be on Hitler. And whether that's pro or con the way they think, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, one important point. The absence of religion does not mean that atheism prevails. And, anyway, I just wanted to make that point because that was certainly the point of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's no acceptance of atheism in National Socialism at all. And there's, most National Socialist Party really did, stand up for Christianity and considered itself Christian. Okay, well, we've got to go. Thanks for listening, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be back next week for to continue on in July of 1941. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour will return next week. exclusively on the White Network.